It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, fewer and fewer people are going hunting in the United States. We'll find out why that can mean trouble for protecting endangered species. First, any fan of the Golden Girls will know that cheesecake was a staple in their kitchen.
I figured this might happen, so I went out and bought a cheesecake.
Oh, Rose, that's great.
What's really great is they fired that gray-haired baker who refused to wear a mask.
Well, let's slice this baby up and see if we can solve our Sophia problem. Here, darling.
Yeah, oh, do you know how many problems we have solved over a cheesecake at this kitchen table?
No, Dorothy, exactly how many?
147.
Cheesecake is one of those desserts that's great to eat at a restaurant. Making it at home can be a little intimidating. You want to get the consistency right and maybe figure out how to use a springform pan. Our in-house cooking expert has been experimenting with cheesecakes, and she's here to tell us what she learned. Lori Skelton is a WPR classical music host and a Food Friday regular. Lori, welcome back.
Well, here's one thing I learned, that Bea Arthur was a fantastic actress because she hated cheesecake.
And she had to eat it.
And she had to eat
camera,
it on
camera.
And looked
like she appreciated it. Wow, that is impressive. And you have some other deeper history of cheesecake to share with us before we get into, you know, how to make it.
I did not realize this goes back to ancient Greece.
Wow.
They mention it in a cheesecake. A Greek physician mentions it about 5 centuries BCE. The first recipe comes from Roman Cato the Elder. He was an historian, and he actually mentions baking the crust separately from putting a fat cheese into it and flavoring it, maybe
wow.
throwing in a little bit of egg yolks.
Cheesecake delendo est, they used to say. Cheesecake must be destroyed.
Preferably with fruit topping.
By eating it, yeah.
And what we think of as cheesecake today really came about in the 18th century in England, but there are references to putting firm cheese and eggs flavored with ginger, cinnamon, and saffron in a crust and baking it as far back as around 1390 in English cookbooks.
Wow.
So it's been around a long time.
It's got a rich tradition. Well, let's take it to today. One thing that we learned on this experiment is there is a huge amount of variety in the world of cheesecake and some of the samples that you made and brought into us.
One thing that most people seem to agree on is, yeah, fun flavors are fun flavors, but I want a good plain vanilla cheesecake. That said, what a good plain vanilla cheesecake will vary from person to person. If you like the what we call New York style, the really dense, the really thick, feels like a brick if it falls on your foot kind of cheesecake, you can make it with almost the same ingredients as something that's a little bit lighter and fluffier, but it's the method you use. If you're baking it without a water bath around it, if you're just baking it in the springform pan on a tray in your oven, that's going to give you a denser cheesecake than if you bake it in a water bath. And then, of course, there's the no-bake version. Sometimes you use gelatin. Sometimes you use other thickening agents. The standard Philadelphia brand no-bake cheesecake has Cool Whip that's folded into Neufchâtel cheese. That will give you, again, a different texture. So it's not just about the flavor. It's about how you like to bake it. I know that Cook's Illustrated or America's Test Kitchens has on their website same ingredients, but depending on how you combine them and how you bake them, out of the same list of ingredients, you can get 3 styles of plain vanilla cheesecake.
I know a common pratfall with your basic traditional cheesecake and some others, a baked version, people don't like it when it's cracking on the top.
Right.
I don't mind it. I'm still going to eat it. But assuming you don't want that aesthetic thing, that fault line on it, how do you avoid that?
You have to think of cheesecake the way you would think of a baked custard. You never bake a custard until it's completely firm all the way through. You take it out when there's still a little bit of jiggle in the middle. You have to let a cheesecake sit on the counter and cool at least an hour in the springform pan before you unmold it. You have to resist the urge to dig in right away. You need to let it rest before unmolding. Ideally, cheesecake should chill at least 6 hours before you eat it. Some of the vegan or the refrigerator cheesecakes I came up with are actually better if they're frozen first. Mm.
Now, different kinds of cheese you can use in your basic cheesecake. There's a variety, it sounds like.
Basic cream cheese, good old American cream cheese, is the one we think of all the time. That's made using exclusively milk. I mentioned Neufchâtel a few minutes ago. That's a combination. Neufchâtel is milk exclusively. Cream cheese is milk and cream. But there is also ricotta, mascarpone. You can fold in sour cream, or a lot of people will top a cheesecake with sour cream. Heavy cream, condensed milk. There's a condensed milk called Milnot that apparently has a cheesecake recipe on the back. I read it. It's you do a lot of whipping of air into this, but that's a little less cream cheese and a lot of condensed milk. It gives you, again, a different texture, probably a sharper, sweeter taste than a standard baked cheesecake. But yes, you can get incredibly creative with the dairy you use. What you're aiming for is something that's much, much thicker than the egg custard base. That's what differentiates cheesecake from quiche.
Talking to Lori Skelton on Food Friday. We are cooking cheesecake. You can join in with your cheesecake favorites and questions at 800-642-1234. Lori, you mentioned ricotta, and that takes us to one of the recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. You adapted a Lydia Bastianich recipe. She's been on the show a couple few times. Tell us about this one.
This is a very specific cheesecake for Rome, and you take ricotta and a fair amount of egg, 3 eggs and 1 extra egg yolk, sugar. She recommends a tablespoon of orange zest. I actually used more than that on mine. Heavy cream in this, and then toasted sliced almonds. And this is another one where you beat the cheese layer of the cheesecake, get a lot of air into this. The other thing that Lydia does for this Roman cheesecake, she doesn't use the standard ground cookies or graham crackers for a crust. She actually makes an enriched pastry crust with extra sugar and egg, and then she rolls it out and puts that in the bottom. I cheated when I made mine. My enriched dough was coming out a little crumbly to begin with, so I just patted it in the bottom of the springform pan and put the cheese on top of it. Now, this is one that I had originally made for a dinner party, and I told Wisconsin Public Radio co-workers, I'll bring in the leftovers the day after the party.
Uh-oh.
And when I was serving the cheesecake, everybody said, oh, just a little piece. And then they kept nibbling at it for the rest of the night. There were no leftovers. This probably was my favorite of all the cheesecakes I tried for this
experiment.
Well,
rub it in. Yeah.
Well, all right. So I'll tell you what. I'll make you one during the pledge drive.
You've made plenty of cheesecake for this one. I want to check out another. And this was kind of a mind-blowing one.
No kidding.
A no-bake. And you ended up adapting it to be a vegan recipe. And, you know,
vegan,
the common cheesecake ingredient, avocado?
This was something that we tried as a sweet dessert in Florida, an avocado cheesecake, nice and fat and dense, with lime curd, creme fraiche, and chocolate shards for decoration. Boyfriend said, see if you can make me another avocado cheesecake. And when I found on the Food Network a no-bake version that had avocado as the main thickening ingredient with a little bit of cream cheese, I thought, I'll bet I can adapt this and make this vegan, gluten-free. And so I used an almond base, like a cream cheese spread, blended in with avocado and lime and coconut. I thought people would take a polite bite and say, interesting, especially because I couldn't use heavy cream, which was the other thing they used to thicken it. And then I found if you roast whole onions in their skins for about an hour and take just the inner part of that roasted onion and blend it with a little bit of lemon juice, it becomes a really good substitute for heavy cream to thicken things. And yeah, that avocado lime coconut cheesecake was gone within 15 minutes.
Yeah, on paper, this shouldn't work.
But it did.
And I liked it. It didn't taste like onion at all with this trick. I didn't really taste the avocado gave it texture, but not the flavor. flavor of avocado. It was really good.
I was stunned. And this was one where I did freeze it, and I think that helped.
That was a good idea, definitely. Talking to WPR's own Lori Skelton about cheesecake on this edition of Food Friday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a cheesecake question, a favorite recipe to make, a favorite kind of cheesecake to eat? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk now with Lori Skelton on Food Friday. We are talking about cheesecake and all its infinite varieties. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your cheesecake hits and misses, your questions, your favorites, 800-642-1234. Find some recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll go right to your calls now. Joan is with us in Dundee. Joan, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you have for us, Joan?
Well, I actually found a recipe for if they're savory cheesecakes. And one of them that I make is salmon and sour cream and chives. And another one is a Mexican cheesecake. And I also have one that I didn't try yet, which is walnut, pears, and blue cheese.
I got to ask you, Joan, Lori made a savory one, and we'll get into that in a minute. What kind of reaction do you get? Do people freak out at the savory cheesecake? Is it too weird for them?
Until they eat it.
Okay, and then they like
it. Until they eat it, yeah. They like it. The Mexican cheesecake, you cook it, it's just like the basic cheesecake recipe with like a taco seasoning. And then when it's almost done cooking, you put some sour cream on the top. And then when you serve it, you put, like, salsa if you wish, and then eat it with a chip. And everybody, like,
fantastic,
devours
Joan.
It.
So you serve it as an appetizer or, like, a side dish, right?
Yeah. And even if you're doing an appetizer, if you eat too much of it, it's beautiful.
Right. Now, you did a savory one, Lori. There was bacon involved. Tell us about this guy.
I'd seen a lot of savory cheesecakes that were plain with just something savory spread on top. And I wanted to try baking a cheesecake that had savory elements in it. So we did a crushed pretzel crust. We blended into the cream cheese dry mustard powder and thyme, and also a fair amount of crisp, crumbly bacon. I'd seen sweet cheesecakes that were maple sweetened and had bacon in it, playing off the pancakes and maple syrup thing. And I thought this would be pretty pleasant. I had one person tell me they thought it tasted good. Everybody else was like, at least when I brought it to Wisconsin Public Radio, everybody else was like, this isn't dessert. Cheesecakes are not, this should be quiche.
Right. Well, here's the thing. It tasted good. I don't think there's any arguing that. It's a marketing thing. I think you have to come up with a name for it that's not cheesecake. Because even I knew, I was like, okay, this is savory. It's not going to be sweet. But the word cheesecake, yeah, put me off of it. And I know you can't call it quiche, but it was really good. Like, the actual flavors together were great.
Mm. This is one where, like Joan, small servings. You can only eat a little of this. If anyone has a chance to try it, I definitely recommend the crushed pretzels for the crust. That went over really, really well. But I think we needed one extra texture in with the bacon, and I just couldn't nail that yet.
All right. We'll watch for future efforts. Thanks, Joan, for that call. We'll go now to Nancy in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hi. I feel your guest is making an error in how to avoid the crack in the top of the cheesecake, because what for me has been very effective is to bake it, not until it's entirely done. Just, well, most cheesecake makers know to what degree it is to be baked. But at that point, then, you turn off the oven, and you leave it in the oven with the door propped open about 5 or 6 inches. So this slow transition from the heat of the oven into a much lower temperature is what prevents the cracks. But when you take it out of a hot oven and immediately expose the whole of it to a much lower temperature, that's why the cracks form.
Hmm. Nancy, thanks for the call. I'm guessing people have different methods on keeping their integrity of their cheesecake.
I'll definitely keep that in mind for the thicker cheesecakes mm-hmm. that I do. I noticed with the last one that I made, we were starting to get some cracks around the edges, and I hadn't noticed that before. So it's a great idea, and it makes a lot of sense. Haven't had a problem with that, but then again, I don't normally make cheesecakes that rise above the sides of my springform pan. So that is definitely one to keep in mind. Thanks.
Thanks for the suggestion, Nancy. We'll go now to Terry with us in Ladysmith. Terry, hello.
Yes, hello.
What do you want to tell us about cheesecake, Terry?
Well, the biggest thing is you know, the no-bake is probably the best one that I've made. I mean, I've made baked ones, too. But the ingredients that I put in is coconut, cinnamon, condensed milk, and Philly cheese.
Yep.
Philly cream cheese.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then top it with whatever you want, blueberries, strawberries, or cherries.
Fantastic, Terry. So no bakes work. And actually, yeah, Laura, you have some thoughts on the kind of things you put on top of our cheesecake.
All right. I realize this is slightly unscientific, but I just asked on my Facebook page, what's your favorite and why? Overwhelmingly, plain vanilla with some sort of fruit topping. So it's always adding some sort of acidic element to that lovely, thick, rich cheesecake, whether it's raspberry, strawberry, cranberry, or, of course, lemon and lime that could be drizzled throughout. There are other suggestions. Eggnog came up. Somebody puts dried berries in their plain cheesecake and lets them reconstitute. Some people change the cookies that you put on the bottom, but for the most part, go for plain with a little bit of acidic fruit, and you can't go wrong.
Thanks, Terry, for the call. We're talking to Lori Skelton on Food Friday. We are making cheesecakes today. I want to go back to the Golden Girls to set up one more of the recipes you brought us. Lori, here's a listen.
What's that? Oh, I'm sorry. I know it's awful, but I have this incredible sweet tooth.
What is it?
Cheesecake.
What kind?
Chocolate.
Oh, I think this could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Well, that must have been early on in the run, but a chocolate cheesecake, and you got a chocolate caramel cheesecake, Lori.
The one problem I've run into with chocolate cheesecakes is that they can be too heavy, just too sweet.
Too heavy for some.
Yeah, well, all right.
Not for me.
So the recipe that I came up with came from Gourmet magazine in 1999, where you first make a warm caramel on top of the stove. Or if you want, you can get a jar of caramel sauce. Warm that up, beat into it, and melt bittersweet chocolate. Then when you've got that nice and liquid and smooth, then you add that to your cream cheese and a little bit of sour cream and eggs and vanilla. And you bake that on top of a crushed chocolate cookie crumb crust. And this seemed to come out for Wisconsin Public Radio and public television folks pretty good. Everybody said that they liked the fact that this wasn't too thick, it wasn't too heavy, and that that crumb crust was just a little bit bitter and a little bit crunchy. So it was a nice contrast to that chocolate caramel that was in the cheesecake. That said, I was using the Nabisco Famous chocolate wafers to make the crust. They are incredibly crispy. And I would actually use twice the amount of crumb crust for this particular cheesecake. Everybody liked that crunch, and I would like a little more texture with it. I think that's why some people think a chocolate cheesecake needs extra chips in it, or crushed peanut butter cups, or crushed Oreos, something to give it some crunch. I'd say go for the crunch in the crust.
We've got a link to that recipe, the chocolate caramel cheesecake. It's an Epicurious recipe. You can find that on the Central Time website at WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Lisa is with us in Janesville. Lisa, hi.
Hi. One of the things that I do is when I'm first putting the batter together, I make sure not to beat it too fast and incorporate a large amount of air that throws off the structure. And I also do the same as the other guests, cool it slowly in the oven. I oftentimes will run a knife around the edge, a very thin one, because when the cheesecake cools, it contracts, and the fat adhering to the side of the pan can cause the cracking on the edges. And one of the favorite ones that I do for a recipe is homemade lemon curd, and I swirl that in the batter before I cook it.
So you swirl it in the batter. Does it end up mixing in, or do you get, like, bands of the lemon curd in the cheesecake, Lisa?
I'm sorry, what was that?
When you swirl it in, does it end up just oozing out and mixing in, or are there like separate like stripes of lemon curd mixed in?
Stripes of lemon curd.
It's like a marbled effect.
Cool. I love it. What do you think, Lori?
I think that sounds brilliant. It gives you that pop of citrus flavor and then, of course, the contrast with the plain cheesecake. I like the idea of slower beating. How long would you say a standard cheesecake takes you to actually incorporate all the ingredients?
Oh, maybe 15 minutes, but I go it very slowly, and I let everything mix each egg one at a time, but very slowly. So I don't get that air beaten in there.
That's really a great idea. I'm going to try that next time.
Fantastic. Thanks for that call. Time for one more call. Dawn is with us in Green Bay. Dawn, hello.
Hello. I was just listening and hearing about your savory bacon cheesecake, which, yeah, I'm not sure what I think of that. However, you said you couldn't think of what to add to it. And if I was trying to do that, I would think like chopped onion, maybe Vidalia, something not overly powerful, but for texture, maybe some dill. And I don't know if you could ever put something like shredded Swiss cheese or something in there, but there you go. That's all.
Interesting, Dawn. That's her recommendation to jazz up that savory cheesecake.
I did have onions in mine. What I did was I fried the bacon and then I sauteed the onions in the bacon fat.
Ooh, nice.
But I'm wondering if maybe you do something like those crunchy onions you put on top of green
bean casserole.
Maybe that's where the onion goes is on the top.
That'd be some good extra texture.
There you go.
Interesting. All right, Lori, are you off cheesecake for a while now, or does this inspire you to more experimentation?
Actually, thanks to everybody who called. These are some great ideas, and I want to go back in the kitchen.
Excellent. I look forward to it. Lori, thanks so much for joining us, as always.
Thank you.
That's Lori Skelton, WPR classical music host and Food Friday regular. She's with us today to talk about how to make cheesecake, lots of different kinds of cheesecake. You can check out a couple of her recipes online at WPR.org/Food Friday. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says 15 million hunting licenses were sold last year. That's down from 17 million in the early 1980s. According to a survey they did in 2016, only 11.5 million Americans called themselves hunters. It was 13.7 million in 2011. Because fewer people are hunting, states are collecting less money in the way of permits and licenses or in taxes on things like guns, bows, and other gear. Wisconsin is no exception. As a result, the Department of Natural Resources had to cut back some on warden patrols and invasive species control. The dip in revenue is also hurting states' efforts to protect endangered species. In fact, the National Wildlife Federation says about a third of America's wildlife species are at increased risk of extinction. So what's being done about it? Colin O'Mara is the president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. Colin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
What are we seeing when it comes to the number of people hunting around the country?
Yeah, we've seen about a 20% decline between 2006 and 2016. We were about 14 million hunters then only about 11.5 million now. So we're kind of across the country, we're seeing the numbers decline.
What does that mean for conservation efforts, the decline in the hunters and consequently the licenses that they pay for?
Yeah, I mean, one thing most folks don't realize is how much funding conservation programs come from hunters and anglers. And, you know, the excise tax that comes from munitions and firearms, as well as on fish and tackle gear, combined with like the duck stamps and hunting licenses, really are the major funding sources. And in an average state, as much as 90% of that funding can come from hunters. And I mean, so when you have fewer hunters, you have less money in many cases. And so it really is detrimental to having kind of habitat products on the ground. And it's also kind of an important part of our heritage that we're losing right now unless we stem the tide.
Are we actually seeing the impact on the ground, cutbacks in conservation projects because of that decline in hunting and fishing revenue?
Yeah, I mean, in Wisconsin specifically, I mean, the lack of funding has prompted the DNR to leave some staff positions unfilled. They've cut back on some habitat management projects. And what we're seeing is that very few state legislatures are kind of stepping up to supplement kind of the lost revenues from traditional sources with some general revenues. And so there's actually a big debate in Washington right now about how do you support this type of work on the ground, both through hopefully getting more hunters involved. And there's something called the Pittman-Robertson Modernization Act that's doing that work. But then there's also this effort called the Recovering America's Wildlife Act, which would actually bring more resources to the states to be able to do more habitat work. Because frankly, right now, about one-third of all wildlife species are at heightened risk of extinction. A lot of the species we hunt and fish are doing better, but a lot of them are in trouble too. And so the funding kind of crisis couldn't come at a worse time.
Let's tackle both sides of that now, and let's start with efforts to bring more people and maybe different demographics into hunting and fishing. What do we know about why people, first of all, aren't going out and hunting?
Yeah, I mean, the scary thing is that as we become more urban, right, as folks are moving into cities, as folks are spending more time on screens, the average, you know, kid in this country spends 50 hours a week in front of some kind of screen. We have an entire generation that's, you know, 30 years old right now that was more likely to play Duck Hunt on Nintendo growing up than they were duck hunting in a blind. And so now a lot of those folks are having kids. And if they didn't have the experiences themselves, it's almost impossible to pass it on unless you go back to the previous generation of their grandparents to teach them. And so what worries me is that we're kind of losing this tradition, but we're also losing kind of the memory of how to do it. And at the same time, you know, as much as groups like the National Wildlife Federation, the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, and DNR and the Fish and Wildlife Agency there try to make it as easy as possible, it is hard to kind of get in for the first time and getting the right gear, understanding the licenses, understanding, you know, bag limits. I mean, there's a lot of complexity there. And so we're working hard right now to try to make it easier for folks. But I do think that the lack of connection with the land for many Americans is driving a lot of the connections that we're seeing around the loss of focus on hunting.
What kind of things on a practical level can you do to reach out to that non-hunter? You know, maybe their grandparents hunted, maybe they didn't, to bring them into the field?
I think a lot of it is just exposure, right? I mean, and you have a lot of folks that want to eat, like, local healthy food. They want to eat organic. They want to buy, like, locally sourced material. They want to know where their, you know, where their protein comes from. And frankly, there's no healthier meat in a lot of cases than, you know, meat that you're hunting yourself, right? I mean, it's local. It's organic. And so we're trying to make the connection in some cases for folks that like the local vore movement to see that as part of a lifestyle where they can, you know, having the idea of, you know, really of harvesting the meat that they're going to be eating. We're also seeing, you know, folks from all kinds of different backgrounds that are expressing interest if they're kind of presented with the opportunities. And so trying to bring more folks of color in, more women into hunting. The fastest kind of sector of hunting growth that we're seeing in the country is women. And we have this great program called Artemis. And the whole goal is to empower and recruit and elevate the voices of female hunters and anglers, because obviously when folks think of hunters in this country, they think of, you know, an older white guy. And frankly, that's not really the face of modern hunting as much. And we're seeing that, you know, frankly, when women are introduced to hunting and, you know, given a little bit of a hunter education program or, you know, just a little bit of an outdoor experience, that the uptake rates are pretty high. And so we just have a lot of work to do in this area. And then we're also doing a lot on college campuses in particular. And like in Wisconsin, I mean, they're offering free classes on college campuses, trying to teach hunter safety. You know, the local vore movement is obviously a big part of that. And then there's this Conservation Leadership Corps that I'm really excited about that the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation provides to try to mentor leadership positions for young folks that are interested in these areas, but maybe don't have that, you know, mentor they can go to on their own, trying to connect folks with folks that can give them these great experiences. So a lot of good stuff going on. I just worry that it's not sufficiently at the scale of what we need, given the kind of rapid decline that we're seeing.
Talking to Colin O'Mara, president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation, about a decline in hunting in the United States, a decline in revenue from things like hunting licenses that funds key conservation programs around the country. Colin, so far we've focused on efforts to bring more people into hunting. Now, how about the other part of this, looking for revenue sources apart from hunting to fund these conservation efforts?
Yeah, right now, you know, at a time when one-third of wildlife species are in trouble, the major tool that we have to bring back wildlife species, if we're not doing it through, you know, kind of the hunting licenses and the excise taxes, is primarily through regulation and litigation, which I would argue is a very suboptimal, you know, outcome in a lot of cases. And so there's this incredible push right now in Congress called the Recovering America's Wildlife Act. It's championed by Debbie Dingell from the great state of Michigan and then Jeff Fortenberry from Nebraska. There's folks from pretty much every state at this point, 175 co-sponsors. And the goal is to bring significant resources, $1.4 billion a year, to implement the state wildlife action plans, which are these incredible documents that each state is required to provide every 5 years, which looks at all the species and figures out which ones are most in trouble, what are the very clear strategies that you would take to address them. And it's interesting at a time when, I mean, D.C. cannot be more polarized. I'm very excited to be talking to you in Wisconsin because, frankly, D.C. is a disaster right now. Mm-hmm. Conservation is one of the few issues that can still bring people together. And so I'm seeing the most conservative Tea Party members working with the most liberal progressives, basically saying, look, we want a more collaborative, more on-the-ground solution to saving wildlife. And they might care for different reasons. Somebody might be concerned about, you know, duck populations in part of the country that are struggling or, you know, chronic wasting disease affecting deer. Somebody else might be concerned about the pollinator populations and, you know, the plight of the songbirds, that report that came out a few months ago that showed that 3 billion fewer birds are on the landscape than 40 years ago. But I'll take anywhere where Republicans and Democrats can agree is kind of a holy grail right now. And this seems to be one of those issues. So it's one of those for your listeners to stay tuned to.
You were on a Blue Ribbon panel on sustaining America's diverse fish and wildlife resources. You all came up with a new funding model to help rare species. What did that plan entail?
So the idea would be to create this matching program that's proposed through the Recovering America's Wildlife Act, and it would basically be dedicating specific funding to implement the state wildlife action plans from the federal government, and then the states would be required to provide like a 25% match. And the argument that we're making is that it's frankly a lot cheaper to invest in that ounce of prevention than later have to pay that pound of cure. And we're seeing that when we do the collaborative work on the ground, not only do species recover much more quickly than if you're trying to, you know, fight your way through some kind of long regulatory or litigious process, but also that the benefits kind of for other species kind of multiply as well. Because if you're thinking about restoring a landscape and you're thinking about multiple species at the same time, you can really kind of get ahead of the challenge and really get, you know, great projects on the ground. And so we're really excited. I mean, that Blue Ribbon panel was amazing. I mean, it had, you know, top conservation leaders, folks from all kinds of industries, folks from, you know, the outdoor industry and different extractive industries. And so for them to all come together and say, hey, look, here's a bipartisan solution that then has now taken the next step and gotten great kind of traction in Congress, I think it bodes pretty well for our ability. I mean, nothing is a sure thing in Washington these days, as folks have seen on their TVs when they're not, you know, so mad they want to, you know, shut it off. But, you know, this is the kind of thing that can get done. And we got a huge public lands package done a few months ago. And this hopefully will be the next chapter in that success.
Now, hunting and fishing, those are two ways to enjoy the wilderness. There are also hikers and photographers and others. Is there talk of trying to tap into them as a revenue stream one way or another?
Yeah, I mean, off and on, there's conversations about, you know, kind of the backpack tax and you know, binoculars and those kind of things. It's really hard right now to have those conversations with the trade war going on because a lot of the prices have been kind of jacked up because of so much of that material is imported, unfortunately. We don't make a lot of that here anymore. And so, I mean, I think there's always those conversations. A lot of states are taking a role looking at, like, conservation stamps and other ways that folks can participate. You're seeing a lot of work around the country around, like, license plates and trying to have other people participate. And I view those as kind of complementary programs. I mean, I think those are helpful. But at the end of the day, I mean, there has to be a larger kind of size of investment. And frankly, the individual pieces don't really add up to enough. Because, I mean, I really want to make sure that we're able to pass on the full diversity of our wildlife to future generations. And frankly, we've done such a good job in this country saving the species that we hunt and fish relative to everything else. And so, you know, I think the key for us is trying to have, you know, a significant amount of federal resources coming in that are then supplemented by very voluntary efforts and local efforts that are in the same vein.
Colin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Colin O'Meara is president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. We talked to him about the decline in hunting across the nation, which leads to less money collected from licenses, permits, and taxes on hunting equipment and available for endangered species protection. The number of hospitalizations associated with the flu are on the rise in the state and spiked significantly this week. According to the state's Department of Health Services, there were 100 more cases of people being admitted to the hospital yesterday before noon alone. They also announced that among those who have died as a result of the virus, two have been children. Our next guest joins us now to talk about this year's flu season and steps you can take to avoid getting and spreading the flu. Tom Haupt is Influenza Surveillance Coordinator for the State Department of Health Services. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Rob. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and your listeners.
So far, how does this year's flu season compare to previous years?
Well, compared to the last few years, it is definitely increasing much more significantly than what we had seen, barring the one exception, and that was the 2017-2018 year, which, as we know, was probably one of the most severe influenza seasons in the last 40 years. We have not reached that level yet. We hope we do not reach that level. But we are seeing, as you mentioned, a very high increase, a significant increase in hospitalizations and cases of the flu over the past 2 weeks.
Yeah, what's happening in these last 2 weeks? It seemed like a normal flu season kind of up till now, and then we have this big jump over the last couple of weeks.
Oh, that's correct. The influenza season has been strange again. We saw that significant increase around the holidays, Christmas and New Year's. And after that, we actually saw a couple of weeks of decline, and we thought it was going to be a pretty mild year. We were very hopeful. And then all of a sudden, the last couple of weeks again, we've seen very significant increases, as I mentioned, in hospitalizations. We had almost 3,400 people who were diagnosed with flu last week alone in Wisconsin, and over 400 cases that were actually hospitalized. This is due partly to our second wave of influenza that is circulating now, and that's the influenza A H1 virus. Previously, it had been the influenza B virus, both of which are cause much more illness amongst younger populations compared to the older population. And when I say older population, that would be over 65 years old.
Now, how dangerous is this flu as far as people potentially dying from it?
Well, yes, and unfortunately, we did announce our second death of a pediatric patient this past week, which is a tragedy. And just want people to know that we really offer our sympathy to the family and relatives of this child. It's something where we are seeing significant hospitalizations, especially amongst young children. We've been in contact with Children's Hospital in Milwaukee, the American Family Children's Hospital in Madison, and both are seeing patients who are severely ill due to the influenza. We're also seeing younger adults, 18 to 49 years old, who are being hospitalized due to influenza. And unfortunately, this age group, 18 to 49, is the one that's the least vaccinated in the state, running about 20%.
Talking to Tom Haupt from the State Department of Health Services, looking at this year's flu season, influenza season. Tom, before we get into prevention and treatment and things like that, a quick reminder, influenza, it is a respiratory disease, right? Not what people often call stomach flu.
That's correct. It is definitely a respiratory virus that leads to high fever, sore throat, coughing that can last a long period of time, and a long period of fatigue. And as you mentioned, should not be mistaken for the stomach flu, which is more of a diarrheal type of illness.
With that kind of respiratory illness, we have some of those symptoms. When should people be seeking medical attention?
Well, people should be seeking medical attention if they have any underlying illnesses that would make them more susceptible to complications of the flu. Certain diseases, heart disease, diabetes, that type of thing. If they're on any kind of medications that would lower their immune system, very young children and very older adults should seek medical attention as quickly as possible so they are put on antiviral medication. And one other instance of when you should see your physician is if you come down with an illness that's compatible with influenza and you recover, you're feeling good for a couple of days, and all of a sudden you start feeling worse, that is indicative of a potential bacterial infection, which could be extremely serious. And we would recommend that anybody of any age, no matter what, see their doctors at that particular point.
Does it make it harder to track a disease like this, given that some people will probably have it in a milder form to where they don't end up going to a doctor and then it doesn't get tallied in the numbers?
That's very true. The numbers that we provide are laboratory-confirmed cases, and we know that there's a significant amount of people who have milder symptoms that are never tested. So the numbers are compared from year to year based on the fact that they are confirmed cases, but the numbers are not accurate as far as the actual number of people who have influenza infection.
Let's talk about vaccination now. How much does vaccination help when it comes to either preventing influenza or lowering the severity of it if we get it?
Yes, it actually can prevent influenza in many people, but it's not 100%. We know that. And for those people who are vaccinated who actually do come down with the infection, it's usually a much milder case, only lasting a couple of days, and the symptoms are not nearly as severe and don't usually result in any type of complications such as hospitalizations or pneumonia. So influenza vaccine is our number one priority for protection, not only for yourselves, but we want to protect those people around you, especially young children, older adults, and anybody who may have an altered immune system.
Let's tackle a couple timing questions on vaccination. Some people might think, hey, we're already into February. Flu season's pretty much just about over. There's no reason to get vaccinated now. True or false?
False. So we want people to be vaccinated. Our general rule here is as long as there's vaccine available and people are willing to take it, please offer the vaccine. We are not at peak activity yet. I think we may have at least a couple more weeks of increased activity before we even start to level off. And after that, we probably have several more weeks of very high activity. There is at least two or three different influenza viruses going around, so it is not too late. We are encouraging people to get vaccinated as quickly as possible. We have about 40% of the people in Wisconsin who have been vaccinated, but looking at that from the opposite end, that means 60% have not been vaccinated. And it is not too late, and it's something that we encourage people to do for themselves and for those around them.
If people got vaccinated in October or November, they might be wondering if it's still working in February and March. Is it?
There should be some protection at this particular point. Yes, influenza vaccinations, it tends to wane a little bit, but not as much as what people think. So even if you were vaccinated in October, you should have some protection, and some protection against a virus that could be potentially deadly is much better than not having any protection at all.
Now, people are watching the coronavirus in other countries just a little bit here in the United States. As somebody who works on these things, is it going to be helpful if the coronavirus is here, if we're preventing flu, so we're taking some of that off the table of our public health system?
That's true. We want people to take the seriousness of the coronavirus and the spread of the virus very, very seriously. It's something the Department of Health Services is working very diligently on to identify further cases and have a proper response. But we also want people to put it into perspective, too. Only less than 5% of those tested for the coronavirus have tested positive. Comparatively, this past week, and the numbers just came out within the last hour before we started our broadcast, Rob, close to 40% of those people with influenza-like illness are testing positive for flu. So we want people to be aware of the coronavirus. We want people to respect the coronavirus, but also influenza, which is a more immediate threat.
For both of those threats, Tom, in our last minute, can you talk about some of our basic hygiene habits that can keep us from catching and or spreading these illnesses?
Absolutely, and that starts with good hand washing. That is probably one of the biggest keys for any type of prevention of any infectious disease. We want people to be aware that if they're ill, please stay home. Stay away from other people. Don't think you're not infectious or that it's just allergies. We want people to respect the people who are around them in their workplace, in the stores, in their families, just to stay away from people if they're not feeling well. Give themselves time to heal. If you have to, I mean, everybody starts coughing from time to time, but we're asking for people to practice good cough etiquette, coughing into their sleeve, making sure that if they sneeze, they sneeze into a Kleenex or tissue, throw it away right away, and wash your hands. Proper hygiene is a big aspect, along with vaccination, to prevent flu.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
And Rob, thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to get the message across to your listeners. We appreciate it very much.
Tom Haupt is the Influenza Surveillance Coordinator for the State Department of Health Services. He joined us today to talk about this year's influenza season, flu season, and the recent jump in hospitalizations statewide. Let us know if you're seeing a lot of flu or flu-like illness at your place of work, at your school or kids' school. You can email ideas@WPR.org, or as always, you can head over to Twitter. You can tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. How's the flu season affecting your neck of the woods? It's Valentine's Day. As we talked about earlier this week, one survey finds that Wisconsin's favorite Valentine's candy is the conversation heart, or candy heart, those little pieces of sweetened, chalk-like substance with romantic messages on them. But here's a twist. An artificial intelligence researcher named Janelle Shane used an algorithmic neural network to come up with new messages to put on candy hearts after scanning lists of existing messages, the ones that, you know, you might find in stores. Now, I follow a lot of her experiments online. There are usually some hilarious and or puzzling results. This one is no exception. The neural network came up with some, you know, maybe decent candy heart slogans like Dear Me, My My, Love Bot, Cute Kiss, and Love Bun. But then things get a little weird. Some of the less weird ones, You A Love, Am Good, we're getting laughs here in the studio, Sweet Pear, and Fancy My Hero. But, you know, these are in the ballpark. But then we're getting way out there. Things like, picture this on the candy heart, Oog Love, Time Hug, it's our board operator, Sarah Hopeful, in the background laughing, Bog Love, Fang, and Whirly Oot. And then some of these will never be on a candy heart near you. Stank Love, Love 2000 Hogs, yeah. You Are Boa, and You Are Bag. Oh, and Sweat Pear, too. There was Sweet Pear earlier, now there's Sweat Pear. Delicious candy hearts with great slogans from neural networks. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.